Hello, folks. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sunsounds, and I have Time Magazine for you today. This is week one of our biweekly issue, so I'd like to read you the cover stories. And our cover story today is Minneapolis, a city under siege. Minneapolis is deep into its brutal winter, but the city is anything but still. After 3,000 federal immigration agents were deployed here in early December, residents organized to thwart them. Neighbors march, monitor school drop-offs, and raise money for families too afraid to work. Signal chats buzz with reports of suspected ICE activity, and whistles cut through the air, warning that agents are nearby. The lives of immigrants have shrunk. Businesses lock up. Parents sign contingency paperwork in case they are detained. Children carry passports in their backpacks. Long before Sanctuary City was a political epithet, area churches were sponsoring refugees from wars in Laos and Somalia. George Floyd's murder challenged a welcoming place to grapple with race and politics in America. Now, the nation's clash over immigration enforcement unfolds block by block. And this is by Julia Taruso. And how Mayor Jacob Frey is navigating Trump's immigration crackdown. Jacob Frey had just helped his 5-year-old daughter into her ballet slippers at dance class when Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara called. Federal agents had shot someone, O'Hara told the mayor, and it was bad. It was Saturday morning, January 24th. A few miles away, an ICU nurse named Alex Preddy had been shot to death across from a donut shop on Nicollet Avenue, the second American citizen in 3 weeks killed by federal agents in this city under siege. Frey rushed for his coat, arranged for another parent to take his daughter home after class, and darted through the door. I didn't say goodbye, which I felt really bad about, he recalls in an interview in his City Hall office. Frey, 44, is in his third term as mayor of Minneapolis, a tenure marked by almost unfathomable series of tragedies. 2 years after he took office, COVID crippled the city's downtown. Then came George Floyd's murder by a Minneapolis cop, catalyzing protests and riots, a painful fight over police reform, and a depletion in the department's ranks. Last June, two Democratic state legislators in the Minneapolis suburbs were shot along with their spouses in what authorities called an act of targeted political violence. In August, two children were killed and more than two dozen others were injured in a shooting at a school mass at the city's Annunciation Catholic Church. The current immigration and customs enforcement occupation was preceded by a scandal involving the defrauding of social services programs. That put the city under the MAGA movement's microscope, which many, including Frey, believe figured in the Trump administration's decision to make Minneapolis the focus of the largest federal immigration enforcement deployment in American history. Operation Metro Surge, launched in December, has brought some 3,000 agents, many heavily armed, masked, and dressed in tactical gear, to this frozen city of lakes, often tailed by protesters holding cell phones documenting their aggressive tactics. Photos showed Liam Conejo Ramos, a five-year-old in a blue bunny cap, being taken into federal custody. Video captured a woman on her way to a medical appointment, dragged from her car, her seatbelt slashed in the struggle. Protesters have been manhandled, pepper sprayed, and at close range, and enveloped in plummets of tear gas. At some schools, absenteeism jumped as high as 40%. Immigrant-owned businesses pull down their gates as sales plummet and workers stay home. Residents monitor preschools, log unfamiliar license plates, and gather in protest, trying in ways big and small to help their neighbors. Frey is at the center of it all, caught between a president who casts him as a radical leftist defying federal authority and a progressive city of 430,000 that wants him to do more to resist the immigration crackdown and regain control. Frey's governing creed, forged in the crucible of previous crises, is that resistance is most effective when it is deliberate and restrained. Part of the pushback is showing that we can have democratically run cities that can work, he says, picking up trash, de-icing the alleyways, removing graffiti, filling in potholes. He's given fiery speeches demanding ICE get the F out after Rene Good was killed by an ICE agent in early January. But in some ways, his performance demonstrates the limits of his power. A reprieve appears to be coming, with polls showing a growing majority of Americans believe that ICE has gone too far. The DOJ opened a civil rights probe into Preddy's death. President Trump softened his tone and swapped out the aggressive commander of the Minneapolis operation for his border czar, Tom Homan, who announced a partial drawdown of federal forces. But a sizable number of agents still remain. There's a very straightforward antidote, and that is to leave, Frey told me. They leave, and those businesses have customers again. They leave, and fear is reduced on the street. But of course, this is not about safety. This is not even about immigration. This is a political narrative that they're trying to conduct. Minneapolis isn't the first city to contend with the consequences of Trump's immigration crackdown, but it has become the clearest warning of what mass deportation campaign that claims to remove 1 million people from the United States each year can look like on the ground, and of the reckoning awaiting more of American mayors and citizens when the federal government turns its power inward. I first met Frey on an icy Wednesday morning as he dropped his two girls off at daycare. The mayor helped his five-year-old daughter to step carefully along a frozen sidewalk as he toted his six-month-old baby in her carrier. It's often the one time of day he gets to see his kids, and he lingers inside with them for a few minutes before wishing them a good day. Riding to City Hall in his dark Escalade, the mayor reflected on the latest attack from the president. The day before, Frey had a call with Trump that he describes as pretty collegial, but Frey reiterates on X that the city's roughly 600 police officers would not participate in immigration enforcement. I don't want them spending a second hunting down a father dropping his kids off at daycare who is about to go to work a 12-hour shift, he tells me. In response, Trump had launched another broadside that morning, saying that Frey was playing with fire. The warning was an attempt at coercion, Frey says, a nod to the recent federal subpoena that he'd been served as part of a Department of Justice investigation. Frey is a Minneapolis transplant, a former professional distance runner from Virginia. He fell in love with the city's trails and lakes and moved there in 2000 to practice employment and civil rights law. In 2011, he helped organize the first Big Gay Race, a charity event to raise money for marriage equality. 2 years later, he was elected to the city council. He didn't leave a legacy here, says a council member, Linnea Palmero, an ally of the mayor's. He's always had to be his own self-made man. Frey campaigned as a unifier, pledging to mend the city's divisive and also becoming the second youngest mayor in Minneapolis polls history and the second Jew to hold the office. Colleagues saw a leader with boundless energy and a desire to talk to people who disagreed with him. The unity appeal collided with the turmoil that befell the city after Floyd's murder, which led to a protracted fight over the future of policing in Minneapolis. Frey opposed calls to defund the police, a position that was unpopular on the left at the time. The critics from back then are on him again now, except this time many are urging him to have local police act more proactively to protect residents from ICE's excesses and to hold the line on non-cooperation with DHS. Not all the attention Frey has received for his impassioned public defense of the city. In person, he is cautious, pausing carefully to choose his words. In the mayor's third floor office suite, which stacks of printed talking points sit on desks. Around a conference table at City Hall, Frey convenes a morning meeting. He asks O'Hara, the police chief, dialing in on Zoom, for the latest intel on ICE operations. The chief reports a slight decrease in activity, then recounts a few unconfirmed rumors. One is that a federal agent staked out a home with a hostile sign on the window. Another alleges that an agent impersonated a volunteer at a food distribution center. Police were also called to a hotel housing ICE officers where protesters had gathered to make noise outside. City leaders have no comprehensive ways of tracking Department of Homeland Security activity. Much of the information that they have about the ongoing federal operation arrives the same way it does for local residents, via viral videos, social media posts, and word of mouth. Frey and his team try to keep track of incidents by following the frenetic stream of 911 calls and dispatches from the independent trackers who blanket the city in organized neighborhood groups. Hundreds are coordinated across more than a dozen separate signal chats. Residents are encouraged to report incidents of suspected DHS abuse to state attorneys and their general website. The mayor's staff of 35 has been bombarded by some 30,000 constituent complaints in the past 2 months. Some have received threatening messages, prompting the office to remove their contact information from the city's website. The hub of community resistance has been the Whipple Federal Building, where people detained by ICE are held in crowded cells. Some report an absence of access to food, water, or medical care. On a freezing Thursday morning, a small band of locals, music teacher, a retired veteran, a grandmother of three, stood shoulder to shoulder screaming shame and traitor as agents drove in and out of the facility in unmarked cars. Frey hasn't visited the demonstrations at Whipple, and while he joined thousands of locals marching in a recent ICE out protest, the self-described pragmatic progressive has drawn criticism from liberals on the city council, some of whom are helping to organize the resistance movement. I personally have never heard of him out on the streets, says Elizabeth Bonin, communications coordinator for the Twin Cities Democratic Socialists of America group, which opposed Frey in November's election. Our community is out here every day, watching over the streets, making sure kids get to school safely. We're delivering groceries to neighbors, we're printing whistles on people's 3D printers, and we're raising money to pay rent because our system of government has failed us. After the meeting with city officials, Frey visits the 24 Somali Mall, a shopping center filled with vendors, many of them citizens who've lived here for decades, selling everything from rugs to electronics to tax services. These days, it's about 50% vacant. Dozens of immigrant business owners were too scared to go to work. Others have shuttered their shops because decreased foot traffic. But as word spread that the mayor was paying a visit, they were warmed. People called his name and grabbed his arms, sharing a chorus of concerns. No one is coming. People are scared. When will they leave? We're working on it, Frey tells him as he buys tea and samosas. Minnesota has the largest Somali community in the United States, and Frey has worked to ingratiate himself. He's picked up some of the language. His older daughter can count to five in Somali. He bristles at what he sees as the precipitating reason for Operation Metro Surge, the sprawling scandal in which, as of January, 64 people, most of whom are of Somali descent, had been convicted of taking state and federal funding for phony social service programs. A former senior policy aide at Frey's was among those arrested. For Trump, the scandal presented a political opportunity. Minnesota is a blue state. Republicans have sought to put into play in presidential elections led by a governor who was on the 2024 Democratic ticket, and the chaos that engulfed Minneapolis after Floyd's killing made it a national symbol of the Black Lives Matter movement. A historic immigration enforcement operation in a city a fraction of the size of Chicago or Los Angeles, one with a lower than average proportion of undocumented immigrants, doesn't make much sense until you consider how it intersects with themes of democratic mismanagement and crimes committed by foreigners. Look, the fraud is real, Frey says, but you do not hold an entire community accountable for the actions of the criminal. Latino businesses have become the hardest hit. The Lake Street Corridor, a commercial and cultural artery, is quiet. Rebuilding a sense of security will take time, even after the federal footprint decreases, Frey says. People need to have confidence in having their home, that they're going to come back to it. Critics say that Frey needs to do more to support the city in the meantime. The mayor is good at translating the surreal reality on the ground for the cameras, say Councilmember Robin Woolsey, who is urging Frey to back an eviction moratorium. But that's not translating to what is a clear, coordinated plan of how he's using the city's reservoir of resources to show up in this moment. Later that afternoon, Frey escorts 24 new Police Academy grads down the aisle of the opulent Basilica of St. Mary in downtown Minneapolis. Bagpipes echo through the church as the officers prepare to take the department's oath to protect and to serve. The work ahead is not going to be easy, Frey tells the cadets. The bright lights, not just of this church, but of the world, will be directly on this department. Trey's efforts to rebuild trust between the department and the city ranks among his proudest accomplishments. We've done a lot of work over these last 5 years, Frey says. The good news is it's being recognized. The bad news is the trust is fragile. The department lost roughly 300 officers in the aftermath of Floyd's killing, as progressives called for an abolition of a federal civil probe found a pattern of discrimination and unconstitutional policing. Meanwhile, each video clip of immigrants, demonstrators, or bystanders being harassed, and in some cases assaulted by federal agents, deepens a perception that federal authority is being wielded indiscriminately and that local leaders are powerless to stop it. Under the direction of Frey and O'Hara, Minneapolis police have adhered to the city's separation ordinance, which dictates that they avoid involvement in immigration enforcement. Part of this is ideology. Minneapolis is a sanctuary, but it's also an issue of limited capacity. For now, Frey has managed to navigate the challenge of the city's parallel police presences, says former police chief Madeira Arredondo. But people witness their rights being violated by members wearing these federal uniforms, and members of the Minneapolis Police Department are not stepping in and intervening and protecting them, Arredondo says. It's not going to matter which uniform they're seeing. The day after we meet, Frey traveled to Washington to meet with fellow mayors in a gathering he called a needed therapy session. He cast his colleagues as defenders of the Republic at this precarious moment. We are on the front lines of a very important battle, he told them. If we do not speak up, if we do not step out, it will be your city that is next. Folks, you're listening to Sun Sounds. It's week one of Time Magazine, and our next cover story is entitled Iran on the Edge. The men who ruled the Islamic Republic of Iran came to power in 1979 after millions of ordinary people filled the streets and demanded the end of a despotic regime. Looking out their windows, in the first days of 2026, they knew exactly what they were seeing on thoroughfares and boulevards. They also knew how to clear them. On January 8th, Iranian authorities shut down the internet and gave security forces their orders. What followed was one of the most intensive massacres by gunfire since World War II. In Tehran alone, thousands were killed. Although the precise toll is difficult to verify, Iranian health officials tell Time that the numbers could far exceed most estimates, with 30,000 people killed nationwide in 48 hours. President Donald Trump had promised that the U.S. would come to the rescue, but it did not. The regime claimed victory. As January wound down, the president pointed toward the USS's Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier group and pressed the Ayatollahs for a deal. Iranians counted the dead. In the pages that follow, five Iranian writers essay the state of the country that they long to return to, knowing for most of its 3,600 years as Persia, it has been the Islamic Republic of Iran for less than half a century, a radical, catastrophic experiment in governance whose final hours will be determined by ordinary people now driven indoors by truck-mounted machine guns. Meanwhile, Iran's economy is in freefall, and the despots quail. As one exiled journalist put it in 2022, the last time that Iranians reclaimed public spaces, I don't know if this is the final episode of the Islamic Republic, but it is the final season. This is by Carl Vick. And our first essay is by Azar Nafasi. When I think of Iran, I think of light. When a friend asked Henry James how he endured the devastation of World War I, the writer replied, "Feel, feel, feel all you can." His exhortation contains the essence of what it means to remain human. Totalitarian regimes try to dismantle our capacity to feel, render us numb, confiscate our humanity, the way censors black out passages in books. When I think of Iran, I think of light. I think of the play of light on leaves, on the water, on mountains. I was born in Tehran, and when I looked out of the window of my living room, I would look at Mount Tamarind, our tallest mountain peak, covered with a halo of snow. I think of that. I think of our poetry nights in Tehran. I think of the writer and the editor Hushang Golshiri teaching us classical Iranian poets during our poetry nights. I think of reading Ferdowsi and Nazami in our living room and the living rooms of my friends. In December, the Iranians rose up in protest. The Islamic Republic spoke its only language, violence. And again, the morgues and the graveyards of Iran received fathers and sons, mothers and daughters. For me, as for millions of Iranians, this struggle is not political, it is existential. The first thing that the Islamic Republic did, like any totalitarian system, was take away our right to live. They did it by literally killing people, and they did it by trying to reshape the citizens, then turn us into figments of their imagination and create a new Iran. I was teaching in Tehran during the revolution in 1979. I didn't know it myself at the time. The Islamic Republic made me understand a lot of things by taking them away. They were confiscating my history and my identity as a human being. They were depriving us of contact with the world, making us believe that nobody cared about us. I felt the isolation they imposed upon us, that this was a trap that we could escape only by feeling, living, and resisting. When I was leaving Tehran, my mother followed me around the apartment. "Tell them," she kept saying, "tell them. Tell the world what is happening to us." I had to write, as Primo Levi put it, in order to rejoin the community of mankind. Last night, I could not sleep. I kept thinking of three people. The only way I can repay my debt to them is to keep them alive through their stories. So I will tell you of Dr. Farrell Parsa. She was the principal at my high school in Tehran. She was very strict. She would stand at our high school door, checking the length of our uniforms. We would make poems and stories about her. She became, along with my mother, one of the first six women to be elected to the Iranian parliament in 1964. She became the Minister of Education, changing the representation of women in school textbooks and significantly advancing the education of girls and women in Iran. The Islamic Republic came for her. They charged her with crimes from propagating corruption and prostitution to violating Islamic morality. A revolutionary tribunal in Tehran declared her a corrupter on earth and sentenced her to death in May of 1980. The legend is they put her in a sack because you are not supposed to touch a woman and killed her by shooting at the sack. Some say they just hanged her or stoned her. This was a time when I felt immense despair. Many Iranians quote what they believed to be Dr. Parsi's last message from her prison cell to her children. "I am not going to bow to those who expect me to express regret for 50 years of my efforts for equality between men and women. I am not prepared to wear the chador and step back in history." I stayed in Iran. And that brings me to my second story, my second person. He was my student at Alama Tabata University in Tehran, where I was teaching English literature during the war with Iraq. He had fought in the war and was very active in the Muslim Students Association, which worked as an instrument of ideological conformity and state control on campuses. He had the power to throw me out of the university, or worse. One day, I was teaching Henry James, and we heard noise in the hall outside. Two students rushed in with the news that this young man had brought two cans of petrol with him, doused himself, and set himself on fire. "They have betrayed us," he shouted. "They have betrayed us." Some of my students made jokes when his body was being carried out, and it made me very unhappy. I scolded them. "You don't know what he has done," a student retorted. I realized there is another kind of death. The regime shapes us into likenesses, hardens the heart. I tried to convey that to my students through the teaching of the novel. A great novel is multivocal, and speaks on behalf of many. The novel threatens the lies of a totalitarian regime like the Islamic Republic, and the novel nurtures curiosity and empathy. My third story is about Razé. I remember only her first name. In 1979, I was teaching contemporary American fiction at a small girls' college in Tehran. Razi was my student. She was a practicing Muslim. Her mother was a cleaning lady. Her father was dead. She was a thin, small girl with her veil framing her face. She was serious. I can still see her face when I close my eyes. Razi would walk with me to the university gates, and we would talk about Henry James and Jane Austen. She fell in love with Henry James, She loved the independent women in his stories. These women sacrificed their happiness, but they did the right things, she would say. Razzie was curious. Curiosity, the desire to know another, is insubordination in its purest form, as Vladimir Nabokov said. You don't accept just what is, but seek what could be or what should be. After that term, I moved to Tehran University. I saw Razzie once on the street. She gave me a sign not to talk to her. It was the year after the revolution, and the repression had started. Some years later, Mata, another former student of mine, came to see me at Alama Talabatha University, where I was teaching at the time. She had been in jail, but had been released for good behavior, and she had met Raza in jail. Raza and Mata had formed a bond in prison over their love for literature. Raza would talk about Henry James. Mata would talk about F. Scott Fitzgerald. At a certain point in her telling, Mata paused. You know, Raza was executed. I can still see her, even in prison, even while waiting for her execution. Raza chose life. She reached far beyond her prison cell through literature. Her bond with the novels and stories of Henry James transcended death and reaffirmed life. When I lived in Iran, my father would tell me that the country is very ancient and was invaded many times. What gives us identity and continuity, he would say, is our poetry, stretching back thousands of years to Fredrovsky, Hafiz, Jami, and Sadi. When this regime came to power, they did more than arrest and kill poets and writers. They tried to erase our cultural memory. They tried to destroy the statue of Fredrovsky, our epic poet, and renamed the streets honoring Omar Khayyam, our poet, astronomer, and philosopher. But Iranian women stood in front of that street and would not let them change the sign. It was one small victory among countless defeats. The regime would call our cultural traditions pagan, but Iranians still make pilgrimages to the shrines of our poets. The Islamic Republic of Iran is the Soviet Union of the Muslim world, a modern theocracy with imperialistic ambitions, and it is an ideology, a system that has failed. When I look at the younger generation in Iran, I see hope. The protests are both new and rooted in our history. Women have been fighting for freedom, gaining ground despite oppression. What gives me hope is seeing women and men, the merchants and the retirees, all sections of Iranian society come together in the recent protests. I have been thinking of Vaclav Havel, who wrote, "Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out." The protesters in Iran show us that freedom is an ordeal, and you even pay for it with your life. And the author of this article is the author of the book Reading Lolita in Tehran. Our next story in the Iran article is Rebellion versus Revolution. This is by Rahman Jabeglu. On February 1, 1979, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini arrived in Tehran after 15 years of exile in Turkey, Iraq, and a little village outside Paris. Millions of Iranians saw him as a spiritual man who would usher democracy and deliver a better economic life. They welcomed him. Khomeini and his supporters delivered neither. Instead, they gradually transformed the Shah's authoritarianism, secular monarchy, into a totalitarian theocracy. From the earliest days of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Iranians found themselves confronted with a political theology that defined the ideological contours of the power struggle in their society. The people's sovereignty and capacity for collective action were eclipsed by an uncompromising monolithic order embodied in Khomeini's leadership and institutionalized through his doctrine of Vilat Ifaha, the guardianship of the Islamic jurist, which concentrated authority in the hands of a supreme religious jurist. The doctrine of the Vilat Ifaha allowed Khomeini to supersede the political views of other government officials and the popular will itself. The constitution was thus wrested from the Iranian people and appropriated by a ruling cadre that imposed its own interpretation of Islamic law upon them. Blind obedience to the supreme leader and his will transform violence against victims into patriotism and a righteous struggle against corruptors on earth. Subsequently, the loss of rights suffered by a wide range of Iranians, Baha'is, gays, feminists, dissenters, intellectuals, and young people with non-ideological dreams, became a widespread loss of identity. But as the population swelled from around 38.5 million in 1980 to over 65 million in 1999, post-revolutionary Iran grew younger and more rebellious than revolutionary. Over the past 30 years, a new type of Iranian who is defined by the absence of ideology has emerged. These Iranians embrace individualism and global culture through the internet and simply want to exist and act as citizens within their society. A new vision of society has taken hold in Iran. Nourished by these new Iranians, particularly young women, and it has chipped away at the legitimacy of the regime. For more than four decades, Iranian women have been trying to reclaim parts of their personal lives upended by the revolution in 1979. One of the defining images of the revolution in 1979 was an Iranian woman in a traditional black shiter chador holding a G3 rifle. Today, the iconic image of the protests in Iran is different. A young woman setting her headdress on fire and chanting against Iran's clerical rulers. Violence has been the primary language of the Islamic Republic since 1979. The regime has repeatedly met economic, social, and political demands of Iranian citizens with prison cells and graves. The 1979 revolution did not leave any space for persuasion, plurality, and mutual cognition. Political authority does not rest with citizens acting together. It is controlled by the supreme leader and the Revolutionary Guards. For 17 years, violence has forced compliance, but it has not generated legitimacy for the Iranian regime. Every return to state violence in Iran has served as evidence of erosion of its authority, a self-defeating strategy to maintain the status quo. Violence substitutes consent with massacre and determines the popular legitimacy on which many government ultimately rests. And yet, after 47 years of civil resistance and nonviolent confrontation, Iranians have converted the loss of their sons and daughters and their private sufferings into public claims. They have built new, lasting repertoires of protest and forms of dissent that survive individual campaigns of repression. Today, Iranians are mourning thousands of their fellow citizens who were massacred during the savage crackdowns in recent protests. What endures, after all the killing, is storytelling. If Iran is to have a democratic future, the differences within Iranian society have to be confronted and argued, though, not buried. That work carries a warning. Ending an illegitimate government is to refuse to support a new dictatorial and corrupt regime. To be an Iranian today is to live within the memory and continuity of Persian civilization, to sustain an ethics of beauty and embody an act of resistance against an ugly and tyrannical Iran. If Iran remains beautiful, then the idea of Persia is more than mere ornament adorning the corpse of an ancient civilization. It is the revolt of beauty and freedom against the ugliness of tyranny and the willful forgetting of horror. Our next essay in the Iran article is Iran's Exhausting Charade. This is by Azadeh Modovani. The Islamic Republic's already lengthy catalog of fears has ballooned of late, alongside the possibility of being overthrown by its own citizens. It is haunted by the prospect of a full accounting of the massacres that it has carried out, by the tenuous loyalty of its army and its empty coffers, and the shadow of Israeli spies and Islamic State militants. What terrifies Iran's theocrats the most, the fear that eclipses all of their other fears, is the ability of the people at large to clearly see the essential realities of the present regime. While Iranians have heroically demanded a great many things in recent weeks, change, new rulers, democratic freedoms, they are fundamentally insisting on dismantling the meticulously curated edifice of deceit and falsehoods, sustaining the state as it has been constructed since 1979. For the first time ever, by explicitly chanting the name of a specific alternate leader in the streets, Iranians have emphasized the true problem, the biggest, the most unsustainable lie of all, they are collectively saying, is the system itself. The founding myth of the Islamic Republic rested on a contract of rule that promised the people agency and accountability. Instead, in reality, it empowered an unelected, ever-shrinking clique answerable to no one but itself. For years, deception remained essential to its survival. Now, soaring food insecurity and hunger have exposed the system for what it truly is, a theoretical fabulism and a real-life con. The profound significance of the recent protests lies in their creation of a vast public space where tens of thousands repudiated the lie in unison. The veil was shredded. The illusion was shattered. Nothing will ever be the same. That is why the regime has killed ruthlessly and killed as it has never killed before. On the road to this moment, the regime's attempts to hide reality grew increasingly more fantastic. I remember during the COVID pandemic when Western countries refused to sell ventilators to Iran. Sanctions are sanctions, and thousands were dying unnecessarily. The regime blanketed Tehran with billboards professing that Iranians had overcome the pandemic together. It's as if one scalding insult weren't enough. Banners claimed that Iranians were triumphing in virtually all aspects of modern life. World champions in sport, fine practitioners of democracy, and innovators in medicine. This, while the regime banned women from global sports tournaments that might imperil their modesty, leading to defections of talented female athletes, while it tampered too egregiously with elections that many people stopped bothering to vote, while people suffered a catastrophic shortage of basic drugs. Every facet of life and governance is presented as the inverse of its lived reality, and anyone who dares to peek behind the curtain, journalists, dissident professors, activists, even, bizarrely, the Iranian president himself, becomes a threat to the regime. The Iranian economy is a grand hall of mirrors, concealing criminal theft on an epic scale. Fake privatizations, hidden backroom tenders, currency tiers purposely designed to favor consumers, and bank bailouts have enriched oligarchs while impoverishing the nation. The regime blames its bankruptcy on sanctions and claims to be working toward their removal while making foreign policy choices guaranteed to trigger more sanctions. We have grown accustomed to asking what Iranians want, whether they prioritize livelihoods or democracy, whether they wish for a king but might tolerate a practical secular general. Yet at every turn, what they have been demanding is an end to the secrecy through which the regime hides its failings and imposes an alienated life of falseness to its people. Transparency is the one fundamental condition that they demand, and with it would flow everything else: accountability, a revelation of the true causes of the country's terminal condition, and the exposure of the regime's structural rot. And folks, that does it for today. We are out of time. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about what's happening. These were the cover stories from this week's Time Magazine, first week of the biweekly issue. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sunsounds. I've enjoyed reading for you today, and I'll look forward to next time. Have a great week. Bye now.